You're listening to KSCO Santa Cruz, Salinas, Monterey, and San Jose, and 104 FM. This is From the Bookshelf. I'm Gary Shapiro. Thanks for joining me. Lisa C. returns to the show this week. In addition to her excellent nonfiction history of her Chinese-American family's experience in America on Gold Mountain, Lisa C. has written several novels and mysteries. These include the bestsellers Snowflower and the Secret Fan, Shanghai Girls, Dreams of Joy, and China Dolls. All of these books are great, but I think her new book, The Tea Girl of Hummingbird Lane, is not only her best, but also one of the best novels ever. Lisa C. has been on the show a few times, and recently we met in person at Bookshop Santa Cruz, where she gave a talk and signed books. It was a full house because Lisa C. has a very devoted following, of which I am a proud member. Lisa C., welcome back to From the Bookshelf.
Thank you so much for having me again.
It was really fun meeting you recently at the Bookshop Santa Cruz here in town. And I saw a whole other aspect of the life of a novelist, where you answered questions and dealt with your public. How is that? What's that like?
Well, you know, it's so interesting because writers are, you know, typically locked up in a room for years at a time, and then they let you out. and then go on the road, you know. Now, not every writer gets to have a tour, and not every writer gets to have a tour of the size that I'm on. But I think it's really interesting to be out and about, and you meet people who, you know, who have read your books. Or this particular tour has been very interesting in the sense that there have been a lot of people who have adopted children from China, and so they either come by themselves, or they come as a group of mothers, or they come with their daughters. And then there's a whole group of young women who were adopted from China, who have been coming and sharing their stories, and some of them I've even just invited them to come up and, you know, come up to the podium, and because there have been a couple of really amazing things that they've told me sort of off, you know, before I go on, and then I've asked if they'd like to come and stand with me and talk a little bit. And then I think the last piece that's unlike anything I've had before is that you know, my mother passed away last summer, and I do talk about her in my talk, and about this idea of mother love and mothers, and how this book is filled with mothers. And so many people have come up just, you know, crying, and they lost their mother, or they lost their son, and so there's the one part where you're meeting fans, but there's also this part where the books and stories, you know, you have this emotional resonance for people. And so, you know, when I'm sitting in my room writing, I'm not necessarily thinking somebody's going to come up and start crying and telling me about the really sad thing that happened.
Yeah. Well, all right, so let's start there. I want to talk about the process that you go through when you're writing. This book is so, I just love the book, and it's got so many wonderful emotional moments and lots of surprises, and, you know, I mean, it's the structure of it is really great. And I wonder, does this just come to you as a whole? Do you know where you're going when you're writing? Do you does it surprise you, or do you know everything before you start writing? How's it work?
I wish I knew everything. I write the last sentence first. That usually comes to me really early, and sometimes it's even before I've had the idea of what a book is about, that the last sentence is there in my head. And I don't know how I'm going to get there, but that's usually the emotional place that I want to end up. And so even though the journey, you know, I go off on all kinds of side roads and things, but I know that I'm going to end up at that emotional place. And then as far as sort of structure, I do write an outline, and certainly this book, and I think most of my books kind of require that because they're pretty complex, I think. I mean, there's a main plot, but of course other plots along the way, and this one starts with the line, "No coincidence, no story," which is an aphorism used by the Akka ethnic minority in China. And so that, you know, that since it's the starting line, right? It's the first line, but there is this kind of repeating sense of coincidences and moments of fate. And those, sometimes I know what they'll be ahead of time, but I also have to really plot those out in a different kind of way, almost like writing a mystery. So I did write mysteries in the past, and I don't know how you feel about it, but don't you feel like when you get to the end of a mystery, you want to know that when the killer is revealed and when the conspiracy is revealed, it doesn't come completely out of left field, that you know, oh, if I'd been paying attention,
right, you don't
I
want
would
to,
have seen that. Yeah, that you want it all to fit together.
Yes.
And so I think maybe it's because I wrote books like that, but the, you know, my historical novels and certainly this book, The Tea Girl, has that aspect to it where certain things need to be laid in a certain kind of way so that when those coincidences happen and when those moments of fate happen, they're not just coming totally out of left field and irritating people.
Well, there's none of that, I'm happy to say. In the Tea Girl of Hummingbird Lane, it's almost like a time travel story in some ways, because in the beginning of your story, I thought we were like in ancient times, and it turns out we were in like 1995, right? 1985 or something.
I think it starts in 1988, and that's so funny that you would say that, because I've had a lot of people tell me or write to me, you know, I kept looking back to the page that said what year the section started, because they couldn't believe that it was actually 1988. And that's because these people, even though it's in China, and, you know, we think of China now being a global economic superpower and all of that, but you don't have to go back that far in time. And even today, you don't have to go too far afield before life is lived in a way that it could have been 100, 200, 300 years ago. And certainly the place that I was writing about, the Tea Mountains of Yunnan, they only got electricity 13 years ago. So, you know, they didn't have television, they didn't have radio, they weren't staying up late at night with the lights on, playing games. You know, it was a very, very different lifestyle. And so the novel starts that way, and you're sort of immersed in this world where it could be hundreds of years ago.
Well, when did you first become aware of these ethnic minorities in China?
I had actually written about the Yao ethnic minority in Snowflower and the Secret Fan. This is about a secret writing system that women in real life invented and used and kept a secret for 1,000 years. And the women who did that, they were from the Yao. And as I was doing research for this book, and I knew that I would be writing about a particular kind of tea called puer, which comes from Yunnan. So as I was looking at Yunnan, you know, there's some interesting things about it. One is that they have more plant life in that one province of China than altogether in the rest of the northern hemisphere. They have more species of animals in that one province of China, which is just 4% of China's landmass, than altogether in the rest of China. And then that biodiversity also applies to human beings. So China has 55 ethnic minorities. That's in addition to the Han majority, who make up about 95% of the country. And of those 55, 26 of them live in Yunnan. And part of the reason for that is it's a real crossroads. It's, you know, they're up against Myanmar and Laos and northern Thailand, and it's an area where historically people have roamed. They've been nomadic and roaming through these mountains back and forth and crossing over borders, whether they're aware of those borders or not. Like where I was, there was one day I was about 20 miles from the border to Myanmar. You know, it's not like there's a wall there or anything. It's just jungle. And so you would just be walking through the jungle into another country.
There's not a wall? They don't have a...
No wall.
Well, So, you know, obviously you did a lot of research, and I think you always do a lot of research. But, I mean, I think when you're researching China dolls, maybe that was mostly library kind of research. But this was like really getting out there and seeing it, right?
Yeah. I mean, actually, with China dolls, I got to interview a lot of people who had been performers in the 1930s and 40s in these Chinese-American nightclubs. But then with this book, I mean, it's one thing to go to San Francisco and do research, but to go up to Yunnan is a different kind of trip. And we were out on these, you know, dirt roads. It's not paved. It's just dirt roads going up into the mountains, sort of hiking from village to village, talking to tea farmers, and just, you know, all the different aspects of people who work in the tea business. And just sitting and drinking tea and talking and hearing about their families and how many generations they've been growing tea and picking tea and what their lives have been like over this last, let's say, 50 to 100 years in that area. So that is a different kind of research, I guess, when you get to go really into the field. I don't know that when you go to San Francisco, you can't really feel like you're going out into the field in the same kind of way. But I also, for the Tea Girl of Hummingbird Lane, I was also interviewing young women who had been adopted from China, not little girls, but sort of 18 to 21, 22 years old. And so that was happening here. So the research, you know, some of it's just straight online like anybody else, you know, and sometimes that's just a way to find something or find someone, which leads me on to something else. But I do research in all the different ways that you could imagine someone would do research, including, you know, finding people who are really experts in the field, scholars and academics, and in this case, tea traders, who would be able to answer any kind of question, but also point me in the right direction, and that I could also call them or email them or send a message on Weibo, which is the Chinese version. It's a kind of texting thing that if I was concerned about if I had a fact right or wrong, I could just quickly ask the question and get an answer back. And so that, I think that, you know, all of those kinds of things work really well, and I know there are many writers who hire people to do their research. I can't even imagine doing that. It's really my favorite part. And then there's also the whole aspect of food. So I try to eat everything that my characters eat, and I think I've done that for every book but one.
So there's almost a time travel aspect for you when you were out there walking dirt roads and things.
Yeah, absolutely. And then I grew up in a pretty large Chinese American family, and we had and still have a family business. It's a Chinese antique store that's been in business well over 100 years by now. And when I was a kid, it was my grandparents and my aunts and uncles, and you know, there were five brothers and sisters, and they all had spouses. And at the end of the day, they would sit in alcove in the store and stories. So even as a child, there was something about that kind, that, you know, sitting around having cups of tea, telling stories, trying to one up each other, but also having this sense, for me anyway, that people who were older than I was were going to have really good stories and really valuable stories. So for me, to go to Yunnan, it wasn't just about sort of learning about the business of how you grow tea and sell tea and process tea and all of that, but it's also hearing people's stories. And that can take a certain kind of patience, and my experience is that older people, they want to tell you their story. And especially in China, I don't know if it's especially in China, but my experience has been that in China, people who are in their 80s and 70s, 80s and 90s, that they've lived through so much, and in many cases they've outlived the people who were significant in their own lives. And so they have this kind of openness to them of wanting to share what happened to them, as move through their lives. And I don't know if you feel the same way, but often we know what the happy moments are, but we don't hang on to them in the same way. You could say, the happiest day of my life was when I got married, or when I had a baby, or when I won that prize, whatever it is, when I hit the home run. There are all these ways that we have these happy moments, but we don't necessarily remember all the details about them. When there's hardship and when there's tragedy, people replay those moments in their heads over and over and over and over and over again. And so if you can get people to talk about those, it's they remember every detail. And they can remember exactly what people said and what they were wearing, what they ate, and what it smelled like. And so if I love that, and I love just being able to sit and listen and then ask the right question at the right, you hope is the right question at the moment.
To bring it back for them.
Yeah. And I'll just sort of parallel to that. That doesn't necessarily happen only in China. You mentioned earlier that there have been a lot of young women who were adopted from China who've been coming to events. And when I was interviewing them, they were all over the country, and so I had about a dozen questions that I sent out. And I just heard from one of them, the father of one of those young women, who said that his daughter had called him and was reading this part of the book to him where she knew that I had gotten that from her. And that in their family, they had never known she felt that way. And so then she ended up sharing them what she wrote and gave to me. And now they've had this deep discussion about adoption and about family and how she, feels about her family in China that she may or may not ever meet. And then just yesterday I got an email from a woman who told me that her adopted daughter is really struggling. And would I send her those 12 questions just so that they would have a framework to start talking? So when I hear something like that, I'm just so grateful that I got to come out of my room, after writing the book. And if this story can be a way for people to talk about their own families and their own relationships, I just feel really incredibly honored.
This is From the Bookshelf on KSEO. I'm Gary Shapiro. Today we're talking with novelist Lisa C. Her new book is The Tea Girl of Hummingbird Lane. And there's so many little subtexts or stories that you tell in the story. I think one of them that I wanted to ask you about is superstitions and religions. Are you making a comment about religion in this book?
Well, if you're referring to what happens in Chapter 2... we don't want to give that away. The Akha people have their own set of beliefs, as many peoples around the world have their own sets of belief, and certainly people in this, just even in the United States, there are many, many different ways that people think about their religion and their tradition, their culture that builds up around their tradition. I don't really think that it's my job to make a statement about my personal view of religion. I mean, I just, or anything. Really, I just want to be in the room with those characters as they're experiencing what's happening to them. I mean, so that I'm experiencing what's happening to them, and hopefully readers can feel like they're in the room too. This really became very clear for me when I wrote Snow Flower and the Secret Fan. And so there's a big section in there about foot binding, or where this little girl is having her feet bound. And I remember early on, one of the early readers from my agent's office said, you know, you don't have to come out and say you're really against foot binding. And then, you know, you're just, this is really wrong that you're not coming out and saying that. But did I say that? I think if in the room and you're experiencing this process with the little girl, people can come to their own conclusions. I don't think anybody would think, oh, yes, foot binding, what a great idea, let's all take it up, you know. So I do think that that's what books should be about, you know, is to allow the reader to have their own kind of journey and explanation, their own journey and their own way of thinking about what they've read and what that means, and what it means, you know, for their own life, but what it also means to other people who are in the world experiencing that. That they should be able to come to their own conclusions.
Well, I remember,
I'm not evading your question. It's just how I think about it.
Well, I remember once when I was a little kid and I was at Hebrew school, and my rabbi was telling me that it was wrong to believe that Jesus was the Son of God, that was a crazy belief that Christians had. And I said, well, why is that belief, you know, any crazier than believing that the burning bush was talking?
Right.
And I got in trouble.
Well, I bet you did.
So I guess what I'm asking is, are you, you know, do you think readers will just look at this, you know, some of these superstitions and think, oh, all of these religions, these are bad, but my religion is good? Or do you think it will question religion in general, or don't you care?
Well, I think, and I just think it depends on the individual person. I'm just, as another example, when one of the books I wrote, Peace and Love, there were a lot of people who wrote to me and said they didn't like that book for the very reason that it's not my religion. That's what they would say. It's not my religion. It's not my belief system. But that's not why I read a book. I mean, I often read a book because it's not my religion, because it's not my belief system, or what, you know, fill in the blank. We're using those words kind of, you know, but it right. could be anything. It's like, I don't know anything about football, but I might read a book that has football in, as a backdrop, and it becomes for me to sort of experience that world. I think for the Akka people, what I hope is that, yes, there's some things with the Akka that are old, you know, thousand-year-old traditions that we might look at and think are barbaric. And, of course, the worst of those is no longer this. It ended about 30 years ago. But there are other aspects of their beliefs that are, you know, animistic, that have a great sort of respect for nature and others. And, you know, it's been, their culture has been described very similar to the Cree here in this country. So in that same way that sometimes people will look at Native American, I'm gonna put the Cree as, you know, representative now of all Native Americans, which of course they aren't, but can see that there are certain aspects of their beliefs that maybe we could embrace a little more.
Okay. I'll accept your answer and move on. You know, you were talking earlier about your mother, Carolyn C., who passed away, and you've dedicated the novel to her. And so I'm wondering if there are elements of your relationship with her in your novel that you didn't maybe even know were there, or, you know, can you comment a little bit about that?
So she, like 12 days before the final edits were due, she was diagnosed with cancer, and she died 10 days later. And I have to say, I really didn't realize how much of our relationship, or how much maybe her beliefs about motherhood, or even my beliefs about motherhood, were in there until a couple of months later. And, you know, even though it's the final edits, you're not done. You still have copy editing and page proofs and, you know, another, I don't know, 6 to 10 times that you're going through the manuscript. So I would say it was about 3 months later that I really could see how much the last couple of years of her life and had really infused the book. And also, like I just said, this sense of what it means to be a mother, you know, and the kind of courage, sacrifice, bravery sometimes that women often have to exercise as mothers. And then just one other piece of that, and this is something I've written about in my other books, and I think it's sort of a, I can't say it's across all 10, but there is a sort of through line with many of them that has to do with this Chinese written character for mother love. And it's composed of two elements. One part means love, and the other part means pain, but that's a mother's love. And I would say that I personally sort of gone through this evolution about how I think about mother love, whether it was as a daughter looking at her mother, as a mother looking at her children, and then, you know, maybe now as a daughter looking again back at her mother. And, you know, we all, somewhere along the line, we all had a mother, and maybe you were close and maybe you weren't, and maybe, you know, I don't know, like maybe she liked you and maybe she didn't. And I know with my mother, people would always say, she's so much fun. She's the person you'd always want to party with. And of course, it's true. She was a total partier. But, you know, the opposite of that is, I guess I'm the big party pooper, right? I'm like the one that nobody wants to go to a party with me. I hope that's not true, but we have these different ways. You know, it's not, you can't say, oh, there's this blanket relationship that we all experience in the exact same way. We all have that relationship, and how we relate to that relationship, and whether it's going up a generation or, you know, to your mother, or down a generation to your children or even your grandchildren. And so it's truly universal, right? It is truly a universal relationship. And so that has all of the complexities of it. I know I keep coming back today to these young women who are adopted,
mm-hmm.
but, you know, they have been raised in these incredibly loving families. They've been given wonderful opportunities. They're living in America, you know, and it's all, you know, they know they're so precious and they're very much loved. But they struggle, you know, they've struggled with issues of identity and issues of loss. And so much so that they have, and I've written about this label that's been given to them of the grateful but angry adoptee. And I really came to look at it differently, that it was less grateful but angry than it was grateful but sad. And this was summed up for me by this young woman who told me that, you know, I know I'm the most precious person in my family. I know it. And yet I wasn't precious enough for my birth parents to keep me as their one child. And so what is that? You know, that's, even though she never met that woman, there's both a kind of a burden, but also a void, an emptiness that can't be filled. And so that's just one, I mean, I can't even say it's one person's experience. It's like a lot of people have had that experience, and that you don't have to have been adopted from China to have that experience. So I know I'm kind of rambling here. I'm sorry, but I guess what I was trying to do with the book, and which I didn't completely realize until after my mother was gone, was that there are all of these mothers in the Tigral. I mean, there's Leon and her mother, and Leon and the baby that she abandons, and the baby who's been abandoned, and her adoptive mother, and that adoptive mother and her mother, and then the two other Aka women, Site and Deja, both mothers themselves, and what their experiences are. So I guess for these last 3 years, I was really trying to look at that relationship and the emotions that are connected to it, that idea of mother love, love and pain, and sort of look at it from different angles. And so was that inspired because my mother had been ill and we didn't know it? Was that, or was it something else? You know, is it no coincidence, no story, or is it just, that happened?
Yeah. Well, of course, Carolyn C. was a writer, so you kind of went into the family business. You collaborated, I know, at least a couple of novels with her, or mysteries or something. And was she a fan of your work?
Yes, and you know, my mom started writing and getting published when I was about 12. You know, if you think back to that period, you know, there weren't a lot of women writers in California. There certainly weren't very many women writers in Los Angeles. She really, in many ways, was groundbreaking. And I got to watch that every step of the way. And why she did this, you know, my mother was a single mom, and she started giving me everything that she wrote, you know, whether it was a magazine article or her first novel, even as a 12-year-old, and just say, read it, see what, you know, as an editor, like, what's missing? Obviously, I couldn't have known too much back then, but I would be able to tell you if the character had a red sweater on page one, but it was now purple on page 12. So, you know, it really taught me to pay attention to things like that, but also, like, if I just had a question, I was a huge reader as a kid, so, you know, if something didn't make sense to me and I brought it up, she listened. And I feel like I did have this lifelong apprenticeship with her. I used to joke around sometimes, you know, it was a good thing they, and my mother's father was a writer too, so I was always say it's like a good thing they weren't plumbers. But on the other hand, they could have been brain surgeons, and, you know, our lives would have been very different.
And your plumbing might have been different. I'm Gary Shapiro. This is From the Bookshelf on KSCO. We're talking today with Lisa C. She's the author of a nonfiction history called On Gold Mountain, and she's written many novels, including Snowflower and the Secret Fan, Shanghai Girls, Dreams of Joy, and China Dolls. But her new book is called The Tea Girl of Hummingbird Lane. There's one thing I want to, one other thing I want to ask you about, Lisa C., because in your new book, The Tea Girl of Hummingbird Lane, tea plays a role. And, I, you know, when I think of tea, I think of this little tea bag. But when I was at your appearance at the bookshop, you had a tea master there, and he had this tea that looked like a pile of dirt. And it's not the way we think about tea, these tea cakes that you describe in your book. How did you already know all about that, or did you learn about that for the book, or what's the story?
I've been a lifelong tea drinker, and certainly the Chinese side of my family, they were big tea drinkers, and they always had cakes of tea. That's a very, you know, it's a way of packaging tea to travel long distances, but also, you know, if you go back 1,000 years or more, it was used almost like money, like a brick of tea could be used as money. And so I was familiar with that. What I wasn't familiar with was this particular tea, puer, and how it's made and why it's so valuable and how it grows in value with age. It's a lot like wine in that sense. So,
how valuable is it, by the way?
Well, I mean, you could go to the local market, I'm sure, and find some that would not be very expensive, but it also wouldn't be a very high quality. There was one cake of tea about a year ago, three years ago, about a little under a pound, that sold at international auction for $150,000 US dollars. So it, you know, it can go from being $3 for a box at the Whole Foods, all the way up to $150,000. And there are people who are serious collectors and connoisseurs. And again, it's a lot like wine. A lot of the language is the same that people use in wine tastings. But you know, most tea. You should, this is going to be bad news for your listeners, but if it's been in your cupboard for more than 6 months, you should just throw it out. It's not, it's lost its flavor. It really isn't any good anymore. But with this tea, with Pu'er, the longer you keep it, it changes. It ferments and it's not that it's alcoholic, but its nature is changing. And over time, it does grow in value. I mean, there are people who are drinking teas that are 50 years old. That's completely different than, you know, a green tea that you would throw out after 6 months.
Or a Lipton tea bag or whatever.
For that you shouldn't have bought in the first place.
I'll go throw them away right now. It tasted different and great. And the tea master at your appearance was using the same chunk of tea over and over again. You can continuously use this pu'er?
Right. So, you know, let's say you break off some tea and you put it in a little pot, and then you can add water to it sometimes, as much as 15 small pots. I mean, these aren't big pots of tea. This is like one or two little servings in a Chinese teacup, so that's, a smaller, having a big mug of tea. And what happens with this particular leaf, the pu'er leaf, is that with each infusion, it's opening up different parts of the leaf. It's opening up different flavors from different parts of the leaf, which, of course, then tastes different on your tongue because your tongue picks up different flavors on different parts of the tongue as well.
It's fascinating stuff. And it does play an important role in the story, which, again, I think it was just a great, wonderful, well-told, well-written, beautiful book. What do you, you have another one rattling around in your head already?
Yeah, I'm about 90 pages. I've already done the research for it, and I'm writing, and I know what the last sentence is, of course, so that's good. So this seems very oddly timely right now, given our world situation, but there's an island off the tip of South Korea called Jeju. And Jeju Island is a matrifocal society. It's not a matriarchy, but it is a matrifocal society. So the focus is on women. And for about 1,000 years, the women there have been free divers. And so they go underwater on a single breath, go down about 60 feet, and stay down there for about 2 minutes and harvest seafood. They are the breadwinners for their families, and the husbands do the laundry, clean the house, take care of the kids. So their society is kind of reversed. And if you just even go back to the 1970s, there were about 30,000 of these women divers. They're called henyo. And that was also the time when finally South Korea let girls come to school. I mean, girls could go to a private school in the past, but finally any girl could go. You still had to pay for it. And so these women divers started saving up their money to send their daughters to school. And so those women have grown up and they've, gone to college. They've gotten some of them are dentists and some of them are doctors and some of them are lawyers and some of them work in tourism. But the main thing they're not doing is diving. And so in the 1970s, there were over 30,000. Now, they're under 4,000. And it used to be that women would retire at age 50. Now, the youngest one is about 55. And so last year I was there, I was interviewing women who were in their 80s and 90s who are still diving. Just remarkable, remarkable women. And just the history of this island is fascinating. I think as Americans we don't know as much about that part of the world as we maybe should. and we don't even know all that much about our role, you know, the United States' role in some of the way we've operated in some of these countries. And so, you know, Korea was a Japanese colony, and then after World War II, it became a nation again. And then in the late 1940s, early 1950s, on this one island, there was a terrible massacre, and you know, 10% of the population was killed. And so, unfortunately, the United States played a bit of a role in that massacre. And so, I'm looking at again this kind of history that is used to women of that island and the culture that these women have of the diving, but also looking at this sort of larger history of what had happened in Korea over the last, we'll say, you know, 70 years.
So it's in some ways it's like your new novel in that it's about and in the same way that it was China Dolls was, that there's this thing that exists that's fading away or that is gone.
That's right. That's absolutely right. That's another through line. I think it's because I love to go out and talk to people who are in their 80s. Those aren't the only two books that I've done that with. And to be able to hear those stories, try to capture them before they disappear, is really important to me. You know, I'm very interested in stories that have been lost, forgotten, or deliberately covered up, and I'm very, very interested in, to say women's history is wrong, but but the role that women have played in history. So I think we tend to learn history in terms of wars and dates, you know, who's on the front line, right? It's generals and armies and presidents and prime ministers. But if you take one step off the front line, who's there? You know, it's women, it's the elderly, it's children, it's families. And they have been there for every step of history. But we don't always learn or know what they went through. So to me, to tell that history is really important. And this really came just from when I was working on my very first book, which is about my own family. And then I, at some point about 2 years of the research, where I could see that there were these larger things that had happened, whether it was a law in California, you know, miscegenation laws, or that Chinese couldn't own property in this state, or things that were more national, like the Chinese Exclusion Act, or even if you went more global and thought about world wars, that all of those, no matter, you know, whether it was something more local or global, had an impact on my family. Because history, you know, it's something that happens to individual people. It's something that happens to families. And if we can look at that individual experience, I think we might have a much sense, a much broader sense, or connected sense of what that history means. I mean, here's an example. Thousands and thousands and thousands and thousands of books have been written about the Holocaust. But what's the one book we all know and remember?
The Diary of Anne Frank.
Right. One girl, her family. And so, you know, I just think that to bring it to something where it's much more emotional and much more something, you know, where you can connect to the characters, you know, in her case real, in my case imagined, but then you can expand from that to the larger experience of history.
Well, that's what happens in The Tea Girl of Hummingbird Lane by my guest, Lisa C. Lisa C., thank you so much for writing the book, and thank you so much for talking to us on From the Bookshelf.
Thank you for having me.
Well, Well, that's it for this week's From the Bookshelf. I hope you enjoyed the program, and we'll come back and see us again next week. In the meantime, check out our podcast page at fromthebookshelf.com. You can subscribe to our podcast at iTunes. You can like us on Facebook. I want to thank my guest, Lisa C. Her new book is The Tea Girl of Hummingbird Lane. From the Bookshelf is produced by Francis Venegas. I'm Gary Shapiro. We'll see you next time.